What a privilege it is to come together and worship God, to gather around this table. The inspiring remarks and the readings this morning and the singing that call our attention to why we're here. And you know, the Lord's Supper is a rededication of ourselves every week. It's a rededication of ourselves to those principles and to that Lord who gave the principles that led to his sacrificing of himself for you and me. It's a rededication of our lives to him and of ourselves to those principles. And you know, if you keep rededicating yourself every week, you gather about the table and we join hearts and rededicate ourselves to that central thought and to that one Lord, it won't be long till you start looking like him and you start acting like him. May God bless us to that end. First of all, before I forget it, I want to express appreciation to Ken Mills for his excellent work in the preparation of various signs and illustrations that are used. He's a good co-worker with me in more ways than just one. But I do appreciate him, and I want you to know that he is having a part in these presentations whenever there's an illustration that's painted or drawn and erected for you to see. I've got a message on my heart today that I hope I can get across to you. It's, I think, very important. The illustration that you see is the one we used last Sunday to describe or to illustrate the two plants that we talked about. Do you remember that? The two plants that are so difficult and they are almost self-exclusive. It's difficult to have both of them in your heart at the same time. An unreserved commitment to God, this vertical line, and then the unreserved love for your fellow human beings, the horizontal line. And yet, how that both of these are qualities, Jesus expressed them in Mark the 12th chapter when he said, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." We found that these are very difficult to have in the same heart at the same time, and yet it's essential, and that Jesus Christ is actually the only 10-10 man, the perfect man, but that we're to grow up into his perfect stature. That's what this is all about. That's what Paul referred to in the Ephesian letter. That's why we're here. That's why there are elders and evangelists and pastors and teachers. That's why this is all together, so we might grow up into the fullness of the stature of Jesus Christ. And we're working along that line for two or three Sundays together. Now, I want to pose a situation for you because it's coming to you, either as a student leaving this general community or as a resident member of the church, as you perhaps at some time or other go into other congregations. It's very likely that at some time or other in your life and in mine, we will all be going out from this place to other congregations. You'll be placing membership with these churches. You're going to be finding congregations, many of which will be very Christ-centered, very Bible-based, motivated by love, and are very alive and on the ball. And I thank God for these good churches all over this whole world like that. But it's naive to think that that's the only kind of church that you're going to be associated with. You're going to be identifying yourself and placing membership with congregations also from time to time that are very cold. They'll be legalistic. They'll be very formal. They'll be very institutionalized. They'll be inflexible. They're going to be very rigid, and you're going to have to decide how you're going to fit into such a group as that. You'll also find congregations from time to time that are very much more open. you're going to find that they are informal to the point of being chaotic. You're going to find them liberal in their doctrine. You're going to find them loose in their morals. And you're also going to find that group of people also intolerable. They're going to be inflexible. They'll be inflexible to anybody that's back this side of them. They're very tolerant and very lenient of everybody that's out there more liberal than they. But you let some person who's more near the Bible standard than they, and you'll find that they're very, very intolerable and inflexible. So here we are. We're all safe and cuddly here today, but the time's coming when you're going to be facing such a situation as I've just described. Now, I want to ask you a question. I'm asking this for all of us. How am I going to fit in to such a group as that, regardless of which one it may be? How am I going to identify with a group like that and find myself serving as a factor for unity? How can I go about being a force for good and a uniting factor in the midst of all this struggle and trouble that I know you're going to be faced with as you leave this congregation? Not that there isn't any of that here, but this is a very fairly peaceable, alive, working congregation. You're not going to find that everywhere. And I want to ask you to consider, how can we serve as a constructive, unifying force as we go out into these other congregations? And you're going to be the ones upon whom the unity and the force and the constructive direction of the church depends for the next 50 years. So we must settle this issue, and I hope we can make strides toward that today. Your major difficulty in this area that we're talking about now, of providing yourself as a unifying force, your most major difficulty in this respect will be stated, let me state it in a very simple, more or less equation. Your task will be to maintain unity in the midst of diversity without the loss of your identity. You think, boy, we're in for it today. How in the world did you ever come up with something that crazy, and how did you ever come up with something that complex? Well, it's not really complex, and it's not really crazy. That's your task. You're going to have to maintain unity in the midst of diversity without the loss of your identity. Now, let me explain what I mean by it. I want to tell you three facts today, and this is all you need to carry with you, these three facts. Number one, diversity is an integral part of life. Diversity. You might as well accept it. It is an integral part of life, even where there are twins who are identical twins. And I married one last night. She was an identical twin. And yet there was something different about her and her sister. They just weren't alike, and yet they were identical. There was some diversity there. But I'm just simply saying that life consists of diversity. And if you don't believe it, travel a bit. Get outside Searcy, Arkansas. Get outside Arkansas. And if you really want to get some diversity, go to California. You know, the land of the fruit and the nuts. But if you can't travel, may I suggest that you just simply go home and look at your wife. She's very different from you, thank the Lord, in many respects. But she's different from you. If you've been living with her for some 20 years, you've already experienced this thing of maintaining unity in the midst of diversity. And a lot of times it's unity in the midst of adversity. But you may have lost your identity in the process. But what we want to find out is how to maintain unity in the midst of diversity without losing our identity. Look at your children. Those of you who have children, you know that no two of them are alike. Not a single one of them is alike another one. It's just that we're all diverse. We're different. Go home and look at your neighbor. Those odd balls that live next door to you. They're so different. In fact, they're just plumb queer sometimes. They're strange. Well, go look at them. And yet, you're still living with your wife, you're still put up with your children, and you haven't run your neighbors off, and yet there's all this diversity on every hand. Well, that's just the way life is. And any movement that is designed to be a worldwide movement, you might as well accept the fact there's going to be diversity in that movement. And the movement of Jesus Christ, which he brought to the earth, was designed to be a worldwide movement. Jesus said in Matthew and in Mark and in the book of Acts and in the book of Luke, these references are given, go into all the world, go teach all the nations, go to the uttermost parts of the earth, and I'm with you always. This simply says that Christianity is a diverse worldwide movement because of the fact that it is worldwide. It's going to be diverse. It's going to contain a whole mess of people in it who are different. They're going to be strange. They're going to be customs. They're going to be backgrounds. They're going to be everything imaginable that will make this a very, what you would just call a mess, a whole, just a mess of people. And as long as you've got two people, you've got some diversity. Christianity is going to be like that. 60 years after Jesus Christ lived and died and rose again, John, one of his closest associates, wrote and said that the church at that time consisted of people of every tribe, tongue, nation, and people. Men and women out of every tribe, tongue, nation, and people. And when the Apostle Paul wrote to the Colossians in 3 and verse 11, he says that the church consisted there of Greeks, Jews, circumcised, uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, free. And in Galatians, he said also men and women. That's 10 different categories, 10 different diverse situations that exist in the church. And Paul said it existed then. And then you add to those 10 different categories, you add all of the personality quirks, add all the idiosyncrasies, the rashes, the allergies, the likes, the dislikes, and all the rest that all of us have. Well, you've got a mess on your hands. That's all you can say. We've got a mess on our hands. How in the world do you expect to have any unity in something like that? Well, it's a good question. When I think it's time we recognize the fact that there's going to be a diversity, there's going to be a multiplicity of differences, of backgrounds, of inclinations, of likes, of temperaments. Everything imaginable is in the church. And when you look at the disciples of Jesus Christ, the 12, you got the same thing there. You had fishermen and tax collectors and I don't know whatever else as far as occupations, but you had people in temperament like John and James. You have people in temperament who differed from them, like Thomas and the Simon Peter and all the rest. And you just add it all up and multiply it by as many people as you've got disciples, and you've just got a big mess on your hands. And sure enough, when you go to the New Testament, that's precisely what you find recorded there. You find this diversity recorded in the New Testament. In the 1 Corinthians letter, and I'm going to have to just kind of hit these and run. I'm going to expect you to do some creative thinking. Let these run through your mind, and you'll identify them. I won't be able to read all of them, but I'm going to refer to them, and you do some creative thinking with me. In 1 Corinthians, the 8th chapter, the first 13 verses, we find there a diversity of knowledge. They didn't all have the same degree of knowledge. They had a diversity of understanding. There was a diversity as to the degree of the sensitivity of their conscience. And all of this was centering around a very hot issue, idolatry. This was not something that was a matter of opinion, in a sense. This had to do, and its implications and ramifications, had to do with this thing of idolatry. Whether or not you could eat meat that had been sacrificed at an idol's temple. Some people said, no, sir, you can't eat that meat. I'm not going to eat any meat like that. Other people say, well, man, an idol isn't anything. What difference does it make? An idol is nothing. And a meat sacrificed to an idol isn't anything. Just go on and eat. Others said, I can't do it. I cannot do it. I can't conscientiously do it. Well, there was a diversity, you see, of opinion. There was a diversity of idea, and it centered around a very important issue, this thing of idolatry. Who was right and who was wrong? Well, there's something there that had to be said, and there's something there that had to be done in order to maintain unity. Paul said, if eating meat causes my brother to stumble, I won't ever eat any more meat. But there was the diversity. We find it in the New Testament church. And this diversity, if you'll notice it, it always threatened the unity of the church. Always. In Romans, the 14th chapter, verses 1, 2, and 3, we find there people who were weak in faith and people who were strong in faith. Paul said, as far as the brother who is weak in the faith, he said, welcome him, but not for disputes over his opinions. Don't get him in there just to attack him on his opinions. In verse 2, he described the man there. Some of them were vegetarians. Other of them could eat meat.
Some said you can't eat any meat, not just that sacrificed to idols. They said to be carnivorous is wrong. You've got to be a vegetarian. Others said, well, man, meat's part of the best thing you can do. It's just real good. You ought to go ahead and eat it. Don't worry about just eating vegetables. He said, I can't do it. So here you were with vegetarians and carnivorarians, if that's such a word. You had people eating meat and those that wouldn't eat meat. In verse 3 of that same 14th chapter of Romans, you have people there who would observe certain days. They thought they were special days and better than other days. Other people, they didn't think anything about them. Every day was alike to them. What a mess. In 1 Corinthians, the 12th chapter, about verse 4 through 11, you have all these different kinds of gifts that had been given these people. One was given a spirit of utterance of wisdom, another an utterance of knowledge, another gifts of healing, another workings of miracles, and on and on and on you went with different functions, different talents, different gifts being given to all these different people. And then in chapter 12 again, verses 12 and 13, you have people who were Greeks and people who were Jews, people who were slaves, people who were free. You have all this in the same church, in the same body. You've got all these different people. And when he says Greeks and Jews, he doesn't just mean Greeks and Jews. He's talking about the background out of which these people came that made them so diverse and so different. The Jew was this very legal-minded man. He was the one who was the 10-0 man. He was the one, you know, that was such a stickler for doing what was right about the law. He was the legalist. He was the one who was going to be, you know, right by the way, and he's going to hold on to the law. While the Greek, the old Roman or the barbarian, they just kind of let it all hang out and they all just hung loose, you know. And they all came in the church. They didn't know what the law was. They didn't have any idea about all this stuff in the law of Moses. And you've got the Greeks then hanging loose and the Jews with their stiff upper lip. And here they came, button head on head. What are you going to do? How are you going to keep them together? That's the issue. Don't think it wasn't a big one. It was a big one. This unity in the midst of diversity was something that just about caused them all ulcers. Look again. In 1 Corinthians, the first chapter, verses 11 and 12, you have different teachers added on top of all this. You have some wanting Apollos and some Peter and some Paul. You have all these differences here with the teachers. And then you've got in Galatians, the second chapter, verses 11 through 14, you have an example of how this thing really got mixed up and it got very heated. Peter went down from Jerusalem to the city of Antioch in Syria, where there were Gentiles in the church down there. And they were going to have pork chops one day, barbecued pork chops, and they got together and Peter was in there with them. He was down there eating this pork with these Gentiles. And don't you know, some Jews, some those of the Pharisees, the Jewish sects out of Jerusalem who had become Christians, they came down and dropped in for an unannounced call. And Simon Peter backed up against the wall and wiped that grease off his mouth and played like he wasn't with those Gentiles at all. And it just about blew the whole thing. You know why? Watch what happened. Simon Peter felt that the diversity of that mixed group was a threat to his identity with his brethren, and so he broke up the unity. He destroyed the unity. And there are all three of these principles in one verse. Simon Peter felt that his association with that diverse, motley crew of Gentiles was a threat to his identity, and so he just simply broke the unity. He says, pull back. And that's in Galatians, the second chapter. In Acts, the sixth chapter, the first six verses, we find there the Grecian widows being discriminated against. The word discrimination is not there, but the thought is there. Oh, you say they were just overlooked. No, they weren't either. They were discriminated against. These Grecian widows were the widows who were not really native born. They were Jews, all right, but they weren't Palestinian Jews. They were from other parts of the country, other parts of the world. And here they had come now, and they'd been converted after having come to Jerusalem for the feasts of the Jews, but they'd become converted while they were there, and they'd stayed on past their finances. Their money ran out, and there was this animosity, there was this hesitation, or this arm's-length religion being practiced by some in the Jerusalem church, and maybe those in charge of feeding the widows just simply neglected them because they were discriminating against them. You've got all this mess in the church, all this diversity. What are you going to do with it? Well,
First of all, you can recognize that that's going to be a part of life. Diversity, the difference of background, the difference of inclinations, of likes and dislikes, and all of this, your opinions, that's going to be in the church. Because the church is so much a part of life, you can't have it without having diversity in the church too. Are you prepared for that? That's one of the facts I want to leave with you. The second fact is that just as much as diversity is a fact of life, unity is a basic qualification or quality, an essential quality of Christianity. Unity is. Diversity is a part of life, but unity is a basic quality of Christianity. Let me say two things. Number one, two verses. God is one. God is one. Now that's stated, it's stated in Book of Mark, chapter 12 and verse 29, when Jesus said, in answer to the question, what's the greatest commandment? When he said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love thy neighbors thyself, there's another statement made prior to that, and that is this: God is one. The Lord our God, the Lord is one. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God, and thou shalt love thy neighbor. But it's based upon the fact that the Lord our God is one. Did you realize that God is one? I think we do. I think we realize that when Jesus Christ prayed in John 17, that he was recognizing that his Father was one. In fact, in John 17 and verse 22 and 23, he makes the statement, Father, the glory which thou hast given me, I have given to them, so that they may be one, even as we are one. I in them, and thou in me, that they may become perfectly one, so that the world may know that thou hast sent me. He asks here that we, might become perfectly one in him as he and his Father were one. God is one. In 1 Corinthians 1:13, this is transferred to Jesus Christ. And Paul said, is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Were you baptized in the name of Paul? Christ isn't divided. He's one. He's a unit. He's united. He's not divided. And then we finally find in 1 Corinthians the 12th chapter and verse 4 through 6, he mentions these things, these gifts, and he says there are varieties of gifts, but the same Spirit. There are a variety of services, but the same Lord. There are varieties of works, but the same God. But he mentions these varieties of gifts, but the same Lord. Varieties of workings, but the same God. Varieties of service, but the same Spirit. He mentions these, the one and the same Spirit he talks about. And then on down in that same chapter, he mentions that again. In Ephesians, the 4th chapter, verses 5 and 6, he says these are two of the seven essential ones of Christian unity. There is one God and Father, and there's one Lord, just one. So God is one. But listen, he's not just saying that there's not but one God. That's not all he's saying. Now, there is just one God, but there's much more in it than in what that says. There is but one God. But Paul is saying that that one God is one. Now, what's the difference? Simply this. The one God is unit. He is united. He is at peace with himself. He's not at odds. He's not a God of division. The one God is one. He is united. He is the same. Now, that can't always be said about people. Last night, night before last and yesterday afternoon, we joined two people in marriage, and the two became one flesh. And you might say, well, who are you kidding? If you could have lived in my house for the last 20 years, though the two have become one there, it's just one mess. That's what the problem is. It's one big fight. It's one big knockdown, drag out. We really haven't been one. Well, that's not the way it is with God. God is one in the sense that he is himself. He is at peace with himself. He's the God of peace. And he's not all fragmented and at odds with himself. God is one. That's one of the facts of the unity of Christianity. God himself is one. Now, the second fact is simply this, that the church is one. The church is one. And I'll bet you think that that's all I'm talking about, that I had been talking about, that there's just one church, that there's one body. Well, I believe that. I believe that there's just one body. I don't believe Christ has two brides. I believe that he has one body. I believe that he has one bride. I believe that that body of people also is one. Here again, what's the difference, you say? Simply this. What I'm talking about is not just the number of the bodies. That's not all that this verse talks about. Chapter 12 does not talk about, in 1 Corinthians, chapter 12 does not talk about the number of bodies necessarily and primarily.
He's talking in chapter 12 about the unity of the one body that does exist. Is the body, how many bodies are there? One. But is that body one? Is the body united? Well, that's another question. That's another issue altogether. And I don't know whether we've ever learned that lesson or not. In fact, I think probably that we haven't. This unity that we can talk about here, unity in the midst of diversity, can be seen in reference to our bodies. And that's the figure that God gives. He talks about the body being the illustration of how unity can exist in the midst of diversity. And I'm going to read this very briefly, but I'm going to read it anyway. For the body does not consist of one member, but of many. If the foot should say, because I'm not a hand, I don't belong to the body, that would not make it any less a part of the body. And if the ear should say, because I'm not an eye, I don't belong to the body, that would not make it any less a part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would the hearing be? If the whole body were an ear, where would be the sense of smell? But as it is, God arranged the organs of the body, each one of them as he chose. If all were a single organ, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, yet one body. The eye cannot say to the hand, I don't have any need of you, nor again the head to the feet, I have no need of you. On the contrary, the parts of the body which seem to be weaker are indispensable, and those parts of the body which we think less honorable, we invest with a greater honor, and our unpresentable parts are treated with greater modesty, which our more presentable parts do not require. But God has so adjusted the body, giving the greater honor to the inferior part, that there may be no discord in the body, but that the members may have the same care for one another. If one member suffers, all suffer together. If one member is honored, all rejoice together. Now, do you see what he's talking about here? He's talking about the oneness of the body, not in the sense of numerical number. He's talking about the oneness of the body in reference to unity. That's what he's after. And he's saying that though there is a diversity of gifts, though there is a diversity of workings, though there is a diversity of services, and though there is a diversity of a background, both social, economic, and whatever else you may find, he talks about it, the ethnic backgrounds. He said, we're Jew in here, we're Greek in here, we're slave, we're free, and yet he says we're all one body. And we can understand that. We can understand how that brings unity if we're all part of one body. But do you consider yourself a part of the body? Do you consider the person, a member who is next to you, is he a part of your body? Is he a part of the body of which you're a part? I don't think we've ever really dwelt on it much. But I'll tell you what, we better dwell on it. And once we come to the realization that we're all part of one body, then no man ever hates his own flesh. Now that's in Ephesians 5, talking about the relationship between a man and his wife. But the same thing is true here. The principle is the same. And yet we treat each other sometimes, as I've told you before, and I like to tell it because it's a good illustration of the little moron who was sleeping on a cold night and his feet were out from under the cover. We treat each other like we were those cold feet. Someone said to him, little moron, why don't you put your feet under the cover? He said, I don't want those cold things in the bed with me. But that's ridiculous. That's why he was a moron. Some of us are acting like morons. We don't want those cold things in the bed with us. We don't want that silly brother or sister in the fellowship with us. They're too wild. Look at it. He's got all crazy kinds of opinions. And why, he's just nuts. What's the matter with him? I don't want to have any part with him. And yet, they're a part of the body. Do you have that concept or not? You know, this last 2 weeks, I've taken a survey of myself, or what you'd call an inventory. And there are parts of me that I just don't really like, of my physical body. I took an inventory about the last 2 weeks ago. Now, I had an inherited hammer toe. I got that. You know what? Everybody asked what a hammer toe was last service. It's a toe that looks down like that while everything else is straight out. It's down like a hammer. And I've had it for 41 years. But it's my toe, and you leave it alone, I'll take care of it. But I came up with a hammer toe, an athlete's foot, one athlete's foot infection, blood poisoning, and a balding head. Look at there. And I just don't really like all those things. I would prefer to have more hair on my head than I've got, but I can't do anything about it. I've massaged it, and I've cared for it, and I've washed it, and I've oiled it, and I've de-oiled it, and I've done everything else, but it just doesn't do any good. I'm going to take care of it, though, because it's my head. The blood poison. When I learned that my whole leg was infected, man, I went to the doctor, and he gave me 2 or 3 shots, and he said, you go home and bathe this thing 4 times a day, and you take all this medicine. You know what I did? I went home and just bathed it like it was just the most important thing. And it was just an old stinking toe. But it was my toe. It was my body. How do you feel about somebody next to you? How do you feel about someone in the church? They're part of your body. They're part of the same body that you're a part of. There are a lot of people in the church we don't really like. There are people, no doubt, in this very congregation that you really and truly don't really, you know, they're, why? And yet they're part of the body. You better take care of them. Now I want you to do something. The fellow sitting beside you, or the woman sitting beside you, or the one in front of you, think of her just a moment, or think of him. Do you ever think of him or her as being a part of the same body you're a part of? If you're sitting real close together, do you ever think about each other being five toes all together? Here we are, all together in one shoe. We're all jammed in here together. They're part of the body. Now I want you to do something. Think of that most obnoxious character in this congregation that you know about. Think about him just for a minute, or her. Somebody that you can't stand. You got him? I've got mine. In fact, I had one for the last service, and I've got another one right now for this service. I'm serious. There's somebody that you don't really and truly care for, and you really don't want that cold thing in the bed with you. You really would rather not have her in the fellowship with you. But you realize that person is a member of the body of Jesus Christ? Do you realize that Jesus Christ died for him and for her just like he died for you? And do you realize that there are idiosyncrasies about you and oddities about you that other people don't like, just like you don't like the odd things about that person? What are we going to do about it? Well, all of us who like each other can get together and go over here and get together and stay together. And all the rest of you can go where you please, but we're going to get with those that we like, me and my son John and us, you know, his wife and mine, us four and no more, and we're going to stay with each other because we like each other. We can do that. And we can split the body of Jesus Christ up into 1,000 different segments. Or you can learn how to do it as Christ wants you to do it. All right. Diversity is a part of life. Unity is a basic quality of Christianity. That's the second. The third truth is simply this, that love is the key that binds these two together. Love is the key that brings unity in the midst of diversity. There's going to be diversity. You might as well acknowledge it. But if you're going to be Christ's people, you better be working on this thing of unity in the midst of diversity. And love is what makes the difference. Now, I'm not talking about like. I'm talking about love. These kids talk about being in like. You know, I asked a girl one time, are you in love? She said, well, I'm in like. And that's pretty expressive. You know, but what I'm asking you today, are you in love? I mean, are you in love? And I don't want anybody to say I'm in like. And yet, I don't think that we've ever developed really very far past like. I think we pretty well limit our associations to the people we like, and we limit our fellowship to the people we like. We don't really go on out into this thing of love. When Jesus Christ said, if you just salute your own brethren, what good is you're not doing anything more than the publicans. They do that. If you just love those that love you, well, how are you any different from anybody else? Jesus is saying that the very nature of Christianity means that you bring about unity in the midst of diversity, and unity in the midst of where there is no unity. Because you're in Jesus Christ, you bring it about, and it comes to be a reality in the midst of diversity, not just in the midst of harmony. You bring unity in the midst of diversity. Love is that bridge. Jesus Christ said, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. And he tells how he wants us to love each other, even as I have loved you. Even as I have loved you. Now, that's a qualifying phrase that says, this is how I want it to be done, even as I've loved you. He's not just giving himself as an example. I think he's saying that I want you to love each other in the manner that I've loved you. Well, how did he love them? Well, he put up with them. He was patient with them. He was kind. He was long-suffering. He had all these things that are mentioned here in 1 Corinthians, the 13th chapter. Christ was patient. Christ was kind. He was not jealous or boastful. He was not arrogant or rude. He did not insist on his own way. He was not irritable or resentful. He did not rejoice at wrong, but rejoiced in the right. He bore all things. He believed all things. He hoped all things, and he endured all things. That's how he loved them. Listen, if Jesus Christ had kicked out in that first year or two or three all those who were doubters, all those who were braggarts, all those who were big mouths, all those who were ill-tempered, all those who were thieves, all those who were, all the other that they were, there wouldn't anybody be anybody left. You just think about it. If he had kicked all these people out of his discipleship the first 2 or 3 years he was with them, there wouldn't have been anybody left. Now I want you to put your name in this list that I've just read. All right? Bill Dials is patient and kind. You little children got anything to say to that? Probably is. Who else have we got? Everett Hufford is not jealous or boastful. Ben Berry is not arrogant or rude. Jim Woodruff does not insist on his own way. Oh. See there? Listen, if we don't get down to more basic things than just liking, if we don't get down to practicing the kind of love that Jesus Christ talks about here, we're not going to make it. We're not going to make it. Christianity is that very religion that brings unity in the midst of diversity. That's where it excels. If unity only exists where there's harmony, then what have you got to brag about? He says the people in the world are like that. Thieves get along together. Publicans love those that love them. He said you've got to love your enemies and pray for those that persecute you. Then you'll be sons of your Father who is in heaven. Well, until the church comes to that kind of love, I think we'll keep on splintering. I think we'll keep on dividing. And you're going to go out into the world, into congregations that are going to be different from what you are. And unless you realize that there must be a patient, kind tolerance within a framework to where you don't lose your identity, but you've got to recognize that unity must come out of diversity. And here's the thing that caught me coming back in preparation for this. I said that you must maintain unity in the midst of diversity without the loss of your identity. It suddenly dawned upon me after I had already worked the sermon over for hours on that issue. It suddenly dawned upon me that it is only in the fact that you do produce unity in the midst of adversity that you establish your identity. That's where your identity as a follower of Jesus Christ comes. When you bring about unity in the midst of diversity, then you'll be recognized as being his disciple. Jesus said, a new commandment I give you, that you love one another as I've loved you. By this shall all men know that you're my disciples. Unity in the midst of diversity, not without the loss of our identity. Unity in the midst of diversity establishes our identity. And I hope you'll consider it seriously. But you know what? You and I don't have much control over the church, do we? About all the control we have is over what kind of people we're going to be. What are you going to do about loving? What are you going to do about loving God perfectly and loving man perfectly? Are you going to work at this thing to where we can all grow to the perfect stature of Jesus Christ, Ephesians the 4th chapter, till we can all go into the mature manhood, the perfect stature of Jesus Christ, the full stature? Are you going to work at it? Well, that's about all you have control over is what you decide to do. May I speak for every one of us today and say, let's pledge ourselves to love God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love our fellow man as ourselves, and then way on out there, as we work toward this thing of being both, not a compromise, but a fusion of the two, then we'll come to be the kind of people that Jesus wants us to be. And what will happen? Will be like you and me as rocks put in a tumbler. Did you ever see a tumbler that polished rocks? How do the rocks polish each other? Well, they polish each other. One rock in a tumbler won't polish. You have to put them all in there together and let them rub against each other and, you know, knock off the rough edges, and they'd rub and polish, and you just leave them in there for days and weeks and months, and you go out there and look at them. Yeah, they're getting brighter, but they do it by rubbing against each other. And that's the way we do it through love, too. We bring about the likeness of Jesus Christ through rubbing against each other and knocking off the rough edges and keeping things going to where we finally get to where we look like Jesus Christ. And it's got to come that way. Unity in the midst of diversity. This establishes your identity as a follower of Christ. Now, if you want to be a part of a body of people who are trying to do that, who will genuinely love you and want you to be a part of them, If you want to be accepted by God and warmly received by people who are sinners like you, imperfect, then you come confess your faith as they have, repent of your sins, turn your back upon them, and be baptized into Jesus Christ today, and they'll put you in the tumbler too. That's right, that's where he'll put you, because he wants you to look like him. And if you're here today and you're a Christian, you are already a Christian, and you need to begin perfecting these things and letting them show in your life. May I urge you to do that too. The lesson is yours. May God bless us with the grace to put it into practice in our lives. Would you come while we stand and sing?